1007.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The last time interest rates were this low, a Rockefeller was governor of New York, Alaska was just gaining statehood, and songs like this hit were just being released in something called stereophonic sound.
Put it in your pocket, never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, save it for a rainy day.
Perry Como's 1958 hit sets the stage for our conversation about the economy today. In the wake of this week's win by the Republicans, both sides are speculating about just what the president can and should do to put a star, or at least a few bucks, in the pocket of the American people. What he should do to stimulate the moribund economy. In a press conference yesterday, Bush said tax cuts are his first priority.
I don't take cues from anybody. I just do what I think is right. Just the way I lead. What's right is to work to stimulate the economy. I strongly believe the tax relief was the right thing to do. If people are really interested in job creation, they ought to join me in my call to make the tax cuts permanent. It's an important part of sending a signal that there is certainty in the tax code, that all the benefits from tax relief don't go away after 10 years. And making the tax cuts permanent is an essential part.
Connection listeners, as the U.S. wobbles between recovery and recession, what should Washington do to fire up the economic engine? And can the government restore your consumer confidence, and make the street safe again? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton, currently a professor of economic, social, and economic policy at Brandeis University, and Stephen Moore, president of the Club for Growth, a conservative political action committee based in Washington, D.C. He'll be joining us from a studio in Lansing, Michigan. We're going to go first, though, to Colley Hutter in Carson City, Nevada. Colley is president of ClickBond Incorporated, a company that makes nuts and bolts for airplanes. Hi, Colley.
Good morning.
What's the nuts and bolts that you're seeing about the economy now? Are things looking up for business or not?
Well, they're looking positive. We're feeling comfortable. We're not overly optimistic, but we're feeling comfortable at the moment.
Now, I would have thought that the airline industry is in real trouble based on what I see from the commercial side. What's keeping you going?
Well, we have spread ourselves. We are fortunate to be a small company in a fairly comfortable niche market, and we were able to work not only with the commercial side, but also with the military side, and we also work with Airbus and Eurocopter, and so by spreading, we have been able to stabilize fairly well. We're down about 3% over last year. But also by trying to rush in and take care of some of the things that some of our larger competitors were not able to do in the faltering economy.
Colley, when you look at all the stuff that's being said about the politicians, the new Republican power in Washington, tax cuts, that sort of thing, is any of this going to make a difference to your business?
I think that if we can make some of the tax cuts, particularly the estate tax and the perhaps the R&D tax credit, which will just give us a confidence that things aren't going to change, is a sense of stability, so that we can focus on our core business and not having to keep watching over our shoulder for changes of that type.
Colley, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Colley Hutter, Carson City, Nevada, president of ClickBond Incorporated. Quickly now to Waterbury, Vermont, where we're joined on the line by Bob Stiller. He's president and chief executive officer of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Hi.
How's the economy looking from your perspective?
Well, the economy, from the coffee perspective, looks great. I mean, we are off maybe 5% from last year, but there's been a real strong increase for us in our fair trade and sustainable coffees. I think the consumers are learning more the impact they can make in the world through buying these coffees, where the money goes to a co-op and goes directly to the farmer and are interested in making a difference with their purchases.
Is the company growing, Bob?
Yes, we're growing around 10% this year. Usually we are more in the 15% range, but we're doing about 15% in sales, and profit is our forecast for the coming year.
Same question I had for Kali, Bob. What difference is Washington policy likely to make on your business?
Well, they're helping us a little with supporting some of the projects we do in the coffee growing areas, which will help our supply chain. Overall, certainly interest rates being low helps us. People having more money helps us. But for me, I'm focused in the coffee area, and them helping, you know, develop more sustainable communities helps me, and to get the story out to the consumers that when they, you know, consume these coffees, the difference they're making in the world, the consumers really enjoy that. So getting that message out to the consumers is another thing that would be, you know, helpful.
Bob, thanks for your time.
Yep.
Bob Stiller, President and Chief Executive Officer of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, Waterbury, Vermont. As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, Robert Reich is with me in the studio. He's a professor of economic social policy at Brandeis University. Stephen Moore is joining us from Lansing, Michigan, president of the Club for Growth, a conservative political action committee. Now, you folks come at this from quite different angles, but I'm going to ask you the same question to start the program. What's the state of the economy as you see it now? Stephen, would you like to begin?
Sure. I think, by the way, Dick, thanks so much for having me on the show this morning.
Yeah.
I think you described it very well. It's a kind of wobbly situation. I don't think economists really know whether we're going to teeter over the brink towards a double-dip recession or whether we're going to come out of this just swimmingly. And I think this is just a crucial point in the direction of the economy where it could be pushed in either direction. And what I've sort of been urging policymakers is, you know, you better take out some kind of insurance policy against a recession, because if we get into a recession, it's going to wreak some big havoc on not just the economy, but the budget as well.
You're saying it's right on the line now, right on the fence. It could go one way or the other, depending on what Washington decides to do?
Well, there are so many factors that influence the economy, but clearly policy is one of those factors.
Robert Reich, what are you seeing when you look at the state of the economy today?
It is wobbly. Unemployment continues to go up by small degrees. There's a net loss of jobs over the last 2 months. Dick, September and October look pretty bad. I don't think we're going to go back into recession, but that is certainly possible. There's a small possibility of something called deflation. Actually, prices go down, and you have a situation where it's very difficult to get out of a hole. Japan has been in that situation for about 10 years. I don't think we're going there. What the most likelihood, I think, is a kind of anemic recovery, almost in the doldrums. But if I can step back just very, very quickly and say, you have an economic business cycle, and we are trying to get out of the trough, but there's also, in the background, a story about widening inequality of incomes and wealth, a story about increasing insecurity among people who have jobs, and also a story about the lower middle class, the old working class, desperately trying to hold on, regardless of the business cycle.
Are you saying that when I look at the newspaper and see retail sales up and productivity up and jobless rate at 5.7, that those numbers aren't exposing this part of the economy that you're talking about?
They are not exposing the long-term both insecurity and widening inequality that transcends, that is, continues regardless of the business cycle.
Stephen, what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. And the one thing I would add to what Robert Reich just said is just two quick things. One is on deflation. I share Professor Reich's concern about this, that if you look at consumer items, for example, if you go into a new showroom to buy a 2003 Ford Taurus, the 2003 models are selling for less than the 2002 models. That's deflation, and you see that in a lot of consumer areas. Farmers aren't making any money on their crops because you've got deflation in commodities. So I think this is a real concern. The only areas where prices are rising are in healthcare, actually, where you have exploding costs. So I think that is a concern. And the other thing I would say about the economy that's a little bit different about this kind of recession, if I may call it that, from the past ones, is that it's partly being driven, and the economic anxieties are partly being driven by the stock market, because we have a different world now where almost half of Americans are invested in the stock market, either through 401k plans or through IRAs or through individual buying of stock. And we've seen a huge reduction in wealth over the last 2 years of about $6 trillion. That's why I'm very heartened, by the way, about the fact that we're in this mini rally right now where we've seen about a 750-point increase in the Dow. I think that's helped settle some nerves among investors.
If we are, as you're both saying, in that wobbly moment where the economy is so vulnerable, I'm going to guess that your prescription for changing that's going to be a little bit different. Robert Reich, what would you like to see happen in Washington? It may not happen now, but I mean, what do you think should happen?
Well, Dick, if we're dealing with the first problem, that is getting out of the trough of the business cycle, getting the economy going again, and putting to one side the long-term structural problem of widening inequality mm-hmm. and job insecurity.
Okay, let's do that.
It seems to me what we need is both a fiscal stimulus and also continued tax reduction and...
Fiscal
when I say tax reduction, I don't mean a tax reduction for people who are very wealthy. They are already presumably spending as much as they want to spend. I mean a tax cut for average working people, such as, for example, exempting the first $15,000 to $20,000 of income from the payroll tax, which is a very regressive tax. You do that for a year or two, and you put money directly in people's pockets, and they are going to spend that money. They spend the money, and that gets the economy going again.
Now, the president's people tell me that the tax cut he's put in place is for the middle class, is for the people that you're talking about.
Wrong. The president's tax cut, first of all, most of it goes into effect after the year 2004, so it's too late to do much about this economy. Secondly, and Steve Moore may disagree with me about this, and I don't want to get into one of these typical conversations about whose data you believe, but you're just going to have to trust me on this, and I'll refer you to a lot of references. The fact of the matter is that the president's tax cut primarily helps the people at the very top.
Stephen Moore, what do you think about the need to push ahead with the tax cut? Is that number one priority right now?
I think it's an important priority. I wouldn't make it my number one priority, although certainly it will be the president's number one priority, and I think it's probably likely to happen that the first bill out of the gate will be to make that tax cut permanent. I think that given the president's strong performance in the elections, that he's likely to prevail on that. But I do agree with Robert Reich that we need something more immediate, and I agree with him that the problem with that tax cut is that, 75% of it doesn't happen until after the next election, and that's too late. And so the area of disagreement between Robert Reich and myself is that what he's talking about is what we call, as economists, a demand-side, consumer-oriented stimulus to the economy. And I think we do need that. But I also think that as a supply-sider myself, we need more impetus towards new investment, new capital research. And I think we need to take away the barriers to business expansion. And that would mean that in addition to doing something on payroll taxes, which I agree with, I'd like to see something like a capital gains cut, which I know Robert Reich will say is for the rich, but I think that's something that will get the economy moving again.
We're going to be talking about those issues. We're going to be talking about the way that the government spends and what difference that will make to you in the current state of the economy. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and today we're talking about stimulus.
Many of the fundamental economic indicators are good. Interest rates are low, so Americans can buy more homes. Inflation's low, so paychecks go further in buying groceries and gas. Productivity of our workers is high. The economy has come out of a recession and is growing. But I'm not satisfied, because I know we can do better.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, can we do better? And if so, how? The president talks about economic indicators that are good. There are economic indicators that are equally bad at this point, and we're interested in hearing from you about how you see the scene, and not necessarily just in the front page of the business section of your local paper, but long-term, what you're seeing in your neighborhood. 1-800-423-8255. Back to my two guests, Robert Reich. You were saying before we went to the break, fiscal stimulus is important. You talked about putting money in the pockets of people through a tax cut so they can spend that money. But you're talking about more than that, aren't
you? Yes, also the government should and can run a deficit, spend more on schools and bridges and roads, public transit.
The government's already running a deficit.
It's a small deficit. You know, the Democrats right now are just afraid of deficits. They have been banging the Republicans over the head for almost 10 years now. About running deficits, squandering the surplus that we had at the end of the 1990s. Well, the fact of the matter is, although I am a Democrat, a card-carrying Democrat, deficits are not always bad. At the start of the 1990s, they were bad. They were out of control, $300 billion as far as the eye could see. But right now, when the economy is sputtering, when you have so much underutilized capacity in the economy, the government has got to step in. If there's not enough spending, the government has to spend and get the economy going again. Prime the pump.
Stephen Moore, you have 10,000 members in the Club for Growth. What would their reaction to that suggestion be?
Well, in a lot of ways, I agree with Robert Reich. I think that the deficit is not a major problem right now. And it's important for folks to realize that the reason we have a budget deficit is because we don't have a strong economy. It's not the reverse. It's not that the deficit is causing a bad economy. It's the bad economy is causing the deficit. And so top priority number 1A for this Congress and this president has to be, in addition to fighting the war on terrorism, has to be to get the economy moving again. And that's why if we do some of these tax cuts that I'm talking about, maybe combining a payroll tax cut with a capital gains cut, if we can get the economy back on this 3-4-5% real path of growth that I think we are certainly capable of, the budget deficit really will truly take care of itself. Right now, we don't have any revenue growth because, we've got people being laid off from their jobs, corporations aren't making money. You're not going to raise tax revenues when the economy isn't performing.
Dick, if I could, I just want to make sure your listeners and to help your listeners, all of this economic stuff sounds rather abstract. We're talking about things that are actually very, very concrete. If the economy is sputtering, that means that you, as a particular person in the economy, you may be losing your job or you may be in danger of losing your job. You're not going to get a pay raise. Your health care costs are going up by double digits. You're looking at your paycheck and you're seeing more copayments, more deductibles, higher premiums. You are having a harder time making ends meet. And if the economy goes into a double dip, back into recession or deflation, or just doesn't do very well over the next year or two, you and other people around you are not going to be very prosperous. In fact, you're going to be pulling in your belts. Now, if you pull in your belt and everybody else pulls in their belt and stops buying as much as you might have bought before, then the economy is even in worse condition. Because if everybody stops buying, then who is going to be, who's going to be the consumer? Who's going to be sopping up all of the stuff that we could otherwise make? You see how it could lead to a vicious cycle.
1-800-423-8255 to Lynn, Massachusetts. Terry's on the line. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to direct this question to Mr. Moore. I am the parent of a severely disabled child who's now 29, who needs 24-hour care. And whenever I hear of people saying, oh, we need to cut taxes, I remember that that's where the money that cares for him is. Mm-hmm. And I want to know from the conservatives in particular, if you institute these tax cuts, who is going to take care of people like my son or my elderly parents
Sure. Or
people who can't work? All of this talk about stimulate the economy and then we're going to have plenty of jobs. These people are not, I've seen services cut and cut and cut for my son.
Terry, just stay with us. Let's let Stephen answer.
Well, I think it's a good question, and obviously I don't want to see programs cut for the disabled by any means. I guess the point I was trying to make is that I really believe, and I think the members of our organization believe, that in the past when we've done tax rate cuts to try to stimulate economic growth, to try to stimulate more employment and jobs, that that's the kind of thing that leads to more not just more growth in the private economy, but provides more tax revenues so that we can fund the kinds of programs that you're talking about. And the one thing I will say is that if we do have a poor economy over the next couple of years, it's exactly the kind of programs that you're talking about, ma'am, that will come under assault, because states are going to be pulling in their belts, just like as Robert Reich was talking about, consumers pulling in their belts. And so there's nothing better for government budgets than a robust, thriving economy, and that's what I want to see.
Yes, but if we don't get one, there's only one place to get money to support people who are disabled, and that's from tax revenues. And I don't think you can skate over, well, you know, the economy is going to get good, so just wait. I mean, he needs to eat three meals a day, and he needs 24-hour care. What's going to happen in the meantime? I mean, Ayn Rand didn't have any kids.
Well, I have three kids, and I want to see good schools, and I want to see help for the disabled, but I want to see a healthy economy. And I guess I'd simply say that if we can put in place the right set of tax policies and spending policies, I think those priorities will lead to both a better private sector economy and also help fund the kinds of programs that you and I both want to see funded.
Let me just take a crack at this, Terry, because I think that with due respect, I think Steve and you are talking past each other. The states, most states like Massachusetts, are under a constitutional obligation not to run deficits. Now, you know, and I know, that here in Massachusetts, there's a $2 billion hole in the budget, and a lot of social services already have been cut, and they will be cut further, probably. That's not good for the economy. I mean, it's not good for you, it's not good for your son, but it's also, interestingly, it's not good for the economy. The states are in the hole, if you put them all together, about $60 billion. It's not just Massachusetts, it's most other states. And if the states start raising taxes and cutting services, that is a drag on the economy. The economy is already teetering. And I don't know whether Steve would agree with me, but what the states really ought to do, if the states could do it constitutionally, would be to spend more and tax less, at least over the next year or two until we got out of this hole.
But if they can't do that, if they are constitutionally prevented from doing that, then they have to go to Washington and say, you've got to bail us out.
Exactly. And what Washington ought to do, part of the strategy that the Bush administration ought to adopt, I don't know, I doubt that they will, but they ought to bail out the states. More money for social services, more money for education, more money for roads, more money for mass transit. That is one way to get the economy back on track.
Terry, thanks for your call. We're going to Raleigh, North Carolina now. Francis is with us. Hi, Francis.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I work for a major airline here in North Carolina, and our company, when the crunch hit, came right down the line with a number of ways that we as employees could save money. The pilots shut down the APUs on the aircraft.
APU, what's that?
The auxiliary power units. They're
right.
A small turbine that runs off jet fuel. So we hooked the ground power up right away. The pilots shut the power down right away. And according to the company, I mean, we've saved, you know, something like $13 million in 1 year just by doing that fleet-wide. Another way is, you know, we're all of our employees are online simply by not taking up administrative time resetting passwords and using that there. We've saved $1 million a year, just a lot of small things that each and every one of us are doing to support our company and our you know, the airline across the runway from us. They just laid off a friend of mine who's a jet mechanic, been with them 20 years. All our guys are, as far as I know, are staying on, and our stock has doubled in the last month.
Francis, what's the message here that throughout the economy, everybody should be taking a look at what's going on in their own backyard before turning
precisely,
to Washington?
Precisely, sir. And I'm very sorry to hear about that lady up in Massachusetts who's looking after her child. But what we do down here is we go to our churches, we go to our charities, we go to our neighbors. We don't look to our government because our government's really never given us all that much. So we look to ourselves and we take care of our neighbors. And I know those people up there would do the same thing for her if she were to look to them. They would dig into their pockets and get back to old-fashioned charity.
Stephen Moore, what are you thinking as you listen to Francis' description of what's going on in Raleigh?
Well, you know, when I was listening to talk about what's happening in the airline industry and with his company, which is probably US Air, which is, I think, based in Carolina, that it's interesting because when you see tight times in the private sector, there is this belt tightening, and belt tightening is not always a bad thing. In fact, oftentimes it can be a healthy thing where companies are looking for ways to cut unneeded costs and to become more efficient. And that's been happening in the private sector, and that's one of the reasons long-term I'm very bullish about the American economy, because our private industries are becoming so efficient. The problem I see, and the reason I disagree with Robert Reich on the need for a lot more government spending, is that the government sector doesn't go through that same kind of belt tightening. In fact, the only area of the economy over the last couple of years that has been growing very much at all has been precisely the government. And so I think what we need more is more private sector expansion and probably less government expansion.
Can we go back to basics here? I mean, in the short term, we've got an economic problem of the economy sputtering. We have too much capacity relative to the number of people who are actually buying goods and services. Now, if you've got too much capacity relative to the number of people buying goods and services, you got to either cut individuals' taxes, and I'm saying especially middle class and lower middle class and working people, so that they can buy more and sop up all of the excess goods and services, or you've got to have government spend more and probably do both. And the Federal Reserve Board has got to continue to reduce interest rates as much as it possibly can. It's just about at the bottom now. I don't think it can do much more. Now, that's the short-term challenge for us. In the long term, Stephen Moore, others, we can have a long, interesting, I hope, debate about what we need to do as a country to overcome all sorts of problems. I put widening inequality of income and wealth at the top of my list. Other people may have other issues. But in the short term, the issue is how to get more demand, more stimulus, more buying. And obviously, government is one of the major players here.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I want to go around to all three of you, Francis and Robert and Stephen, just on the question of Francis has left us, sorry. But Robert, maybe you can just begin and then to Stephen on whether or not, though, we haven't evolved to a point where we go, things are bad, government has to fix it, and whether or not Francis has anything to teach us about. You know, it's not always about the politicians. It's not always about fiscal policy. Is there wisdom in that, Robert?
Well, of course there is. I mean, I am all in favor of charity and neighbors and neighborliness and also churches and synagogues and the private sector and self-sufficiency, a very basic American idea and ideal.
I'm hearing a big butt
coming
here.
But let's not forget, I mean, at its best, and unfortunately, it always doesn't achieve its best. Government is the embodiment of our ideals and our hopes and our aspirations. If we want good schools, if we want good highways and good mass transit, if we want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity, we have got to accept the reality that we owe something to one another. And part of that expression has got to be through government. You can't just wipe the slate clean and expect neighborliness and charities and religious institutions are going to do all of the work of society. That's absurd.
And I guess my attitude about that, and this is, I guess, the area where Robert Reich and I probably most seriously disagree, is that as I look at the American economy, again, over the last 3 years, the government sector at the state, local, and federal level has been growing by about 6% per year, and yet the private sector, where most of the wealth is created in the American economy, is growing by less than 1%. And so I always use this analogy as like a retired swimsuit model, that the American economy is growing in all the wrong places. And so I want to see a shift out of spending in the government sector into the more productive areas like the airline industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the automobile industry. And to some extent, when the government is spending that money that Robert Reich wants to see, that's less money that can be used for private sector investment and capital purchases and the things that really generate wealth creation.
Well... Steve, I know. I mean, if we're talking long term here, if you look at the airline industry, how could you possibly say the airline industry is private sector? The airline industry right now is going to government for a massive bailout.
And I'm not in favor of that.
Well, but the airline industry says if you don't give us a bailout, we're going to shrink. We're not going to be able to be prosperous. Look at the pharmaceutical industry. It relies on the National Institutes of Health for its long term research and development. It relies on government decisions about patent protections and intellectual property law. You know, the problem we get into when we talk long-term, and by the way, the conversation has now shifted out of the what do we do right now to get the economy going to a long-term philosophical question about the role of government in the economy. Once we go long-term, it seems to me we are fooling ourselves if we think that there is a sharp division between public sector and private sector. Look at our agricultural industry. I mean, that is completely dependent on a huge government handout. You want to get rid of that? I would like to get rid of those government subsidies for agriculture, Steve. But you take away all of the government tax breaks, all of the subsidies for the private sector, I'd be happy. I call a lot of that corporate welfare. But would you support all of the reductions in the ways that a government helps the private sector?
Well, look, I think, you know, one of the things you and I agree on, and we've both written on this, is getting rid of some of these corporate welfare subsidies, which are in some cases in the hundreds of billions of dollars. But I'm only making the case that I really believe if one of the primary problems with the economy right now is there's a shortage of capital investment going on by businesses. The venture capital business, which is provides the seed capital for all the exciting new industries of the future, is totally dormant. And we need something like a capital gains cut to get those industries moving again, or we're not going to get that long-term growth that you and I both want to see.
Well, I think that's absolutely wrong, because most of the capital we're getting right now, $1 billion a day, is coming in from overseas. It's a global capital market. Investors are not in the United States failing to invest because they can't get a capital gains tax cut. They're not investing because they're worried that consumers are not going to be out there for the goods and services that are being produced, and they are looking at huge overcapacity in everything from fiber optic cable all the way through most of our technology sector. A capital goods glut right now, and that makes investors very, very nervous.
Quick last word to you, Stephen.
Well, if you look at foreign investment, one of the reasons the stock market has been down so much over the last 2.5 years is precisely not because Americans are pulling out of the U.S. stock market, but because foreigners are. And one way to bring that investment back in is to cut the tax on those kinds of investments.
Connection listeners, it's the same question. How to kickstart the economy, priming the pump, tax cuts, government spending, short-term measures, long-term goals. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. Our topic, this week's three-point win for the Republicans and what they're going to do with that in economic terms, stimulating the economy. The conversation is about tax cuts. We're kind of skating between the long-term and the short-term issues here on the program today, but we're interested in hearing from you about your perspective. We're going to start with Somerville, Massachusetts. Kate is on the line. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. My question is that there seem to be a lot of analogies between the current times and the Reagan era, and I mean, I don't think trickle-down economics worked then. It's a huge contributor to the economic disparity that we see now in the country. And how do you propose, if you're going to talk about tax cuts for the upper echelon of society, how are you proposing to prevent trickle-down economics from having an even worse effect in terms of disparity in 10 years?
Stephen.
Well, obviously, I have a very different take on the 1980s, having lived through the 1970s and seen the horrible inflation and economic malaise that was really turned around almost on a dime, I think, by those supply-side tax cuts as well as sweating the inflation out of the system. When I got out of college in 1981, I remember when we had 20% mortgage interest rates, and you couldn't, as a college graduate, you couldn't even get a job as a burger flipper back then. So when you compare today with what it was like in that mini depression of 78 to 81, 82, I think that what we really saw with the Reagan policies is exactly what we need right now, was a set of policies that created one of the greatest economic expansions that lasted from around 1982 through the year 2000. It created a massive increase in wealth that was widely shared, a huge expansion in jobs. And I think it was, those are the kinds of policies I think we need to put in place right now.
But didn't Reagan do that in large part, Stephen, by running up a deficit, talking small government, but the deficit got a lot larger under him. He was spending money.
It sure did. And this is why I think the one thing that Robert Reich and I agree on is that when you're in tough times, running a deficit isn't necessarily such a bad idea. Now, in the early 80s, the main reason we had the big deficit was, of course, we had the huge military expansion to fight and I think win the Cold War. We are now in a current situation. We haven't talked at all during this discussion about the fact that we're going to probably be spending more money on the military over the next few years, and it's certainly appropriate to borrow for those kinds of large capital expenditures, like building, you know, buying new tanks and planes and jets and putting our men in uniform.
But you're talking about policies that have had the effect now 20 years later, where there's a significant population in this country that has trouble putting food on the table for their children every day. And that is, at least in my mind, that's at least in part resulting from those policies that you saw in the 1980s.
Well, all I would simply say is there were a lot more poor people in the 1970s during that terrible decade of high inflation and a recession than there are now. You really can't even compare. As bad as the economy is now, it's not even comparable to what we had in the late 70s and early 80s.
Kate, if I can, this is Bob Reich. Trickle-down economics, and here I disagree with Steve Moore, trickle-down economics is one of those unfortunate economic theories to have been tried in practice and shown to be bankrupt. We did find, by the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, two consequences of trickle-down economics. One, you alluded to. The rich got much richer. And by the end of the 1990s, by the way, given that our tax code and the way we structured the economy made the rich even richer, it strikes me as absolutely absurd to talk about more tax cuts for the people at the top. The second consequence, and I know this because I got to Washington as part of Bill Clinton's administration at the end of 1992, beginning of 1993, was gigantic deficits as large, well, you know, the old figure was $300 billion a year, as long and as wide as the eye could see. And when you get that kind of deficit spending, then you've got to do something about it. We had to reduce those deficits. I felt like, we arrived in Washington with a giant pooper scooper. We had to clean up the mess left by 12 years of Republicans who believed in trickle-down economics. The alternative to trickle-down economics is bubble-up economics. That is, you invest in people, in their schools, in their health, in their capacity to be productive citizens, and you give them the ability to make the economy grow because they are so much more productive. It's more equitable. It gives everybody a stake in the economy. It's what we ought to be doing over the long term, and we should even be doing it in the short term because government spending right now is perfectly appropriate given that we have so much underutilized capacity.
Kate, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to move along. We've got people lined up here. I'm going to Louisville, Kentucky, and Tom's on the line. Hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
I'm going to disagree with Mr. Reich, although that sounds a little like disagreeing with Stephen Hawking or something. But the issue of deficit spending, particularly on the state level, the reason why we have all these constitutional amendments to prevent that is because I think governments naturally get out of control with their deficit spending. And while I also agree that some stimulus would be a great idea right now, letting loose the dogs of deficit spending will put us back in that pooper scooper environment that you so eloquently spoke of. So what I'd like to know is, why can't we do like the gentleman in Raleigh? Let's let the government tighten its belt. Let's stop doing big digs and let's stop doing fruit fly experiments. There must be plenty of waste that we can eliminate from the budget and transfer some of that to more productive uses.
Yeah, Tom, again, short term, bear with me on this. You've got an economy here in the United States where you've got more capacity to produce goods and services than we have buyers. Too much supply, too little demand. How do you stimulate demand in the short term so that everybody can be employed, or most people can be employed, and the economy can utilize all of that productive capacity? Well, you can have a tax cut for average working people, put more money in their pockets. I've talked about reducing the payroll tax. I think that's a good idea. You can spend more money, government, particularly on vital social services that have a big payoff in the future, healthcare, education, and so forth. You don't want to get too out of control, as we did in the 1980s and 90s. You don't want to have $300 billion deficits every year, but government can spend up to the point where it sops up some of that excessive capacity. And finally, the Federal Reserve Board can reduce interest rates and give people a break so they can, you know, refinance their homes and cash in some of their home equity. Now, all of that is useful in the short term. In the longer term, you've got an interesting question about how you give people a better life. Overcome widening, and you have to admit, Tom, inequality in America today is a scandal. The top 1%, the top 0.1% is taking home not only a huge portion of the national income, but is sitting on a huge portion of the national wealth. And we haven't seen anything like this since the 1920s. There are many things that we can do about it, but we've got to, first of all, admit it's a problem. And I don't see the Bush administration getting close to that, nor do Democrats.
Tom.
Do you believe that that the wealth disparity is a problem if all segments of all income brackets are improving their lot in life? If everyone's getting better, if the richest 1% are getting really, really better, I'm not sure I care so much.
Well, that's an interesting, Tom, that's an interesting thought experiment. That is, and people at home can actually ask themselves this. Supposing I could snap my fingers and we could have a much larger economy, but in that economy, people at the bottom only gain a tiny bit, people in the middle gain a little bit more, and people at the top gain a lot. Everybody is better off, people at the bottom are better off too, but inequality widens. Would you accept that deal? Now, maybe you would, but I can venture to say that a lot of people would not, because with inequality comes also inequality of power, political power. You start distorting the way we as a democracy function.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Stephen Moore, can I hear from you?
The problem with that is if you want total equality, you have to go to places like Cambodia where everybody
equality.
Is poor. Well, look, I mean, I think what you just said is kind of nonsensical. There's something called Pareto optimality, and if everybody is better off, but some people are a little bit more better off than others, it's still the direction that we want to go in. What we want to make sure is that we're not moving in a direction where the rich are getting richer, but the poor are getting poorer. But that's not actually what's been happening in the American economy. We really have been, over the last 20 years, an economy that generally has been lifting, a tide that's lifted all boats. And I agree with you. I want to see a policy where we are oriented towards creating more wealth and more income for everyone. And I think one of the fundamental differences right now between the right and the left, where I'd say be on the right and you on the left, is that on the right, what we're concerned about is creating more wealth. And what I hear from you is more redistributing the wealth. And I think the American people have sort of rejected that model. They're not interested in wealth redistribution. They're interested in wealth creation.
Well, if I can just interject very, very quickly, I think we want a set of public policies that do end up in making the middle class and working class and the poor better off, but better off by investing in their productive capacity to be participants in this economy, and that means faster growth. In other words, I don't see a trade-off between inequality and growth. I see that a move toward greater equality based on education and training and healthcare can lead to greater growth.
I'm going to see if we can sneak in one more call before the end of the program. Rick's on the line from Durham, North Carolina. Rick, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that, you know, for all your talk about the Republicans and the Democrats and all this BS, I've been unemployed for 2 years, except for a couple of small contracting jobs. And as far as I'm concerned, we're in a big depression. I like your one fellow's comment about the bubble-up stimulus of the economy where you'd try to encourage new businesses. Yes, I have an idea for a low-temperature power generation plant. If I could get grant money to launch it and to maybe start a new company and employ more people and get some more people on the payroll.
But are you saying, Rick, that it doesn't matter whether it's Republicans or the Democrats in power? That's sort of how you began.
Yes. I feel that they're both irrelevant. That's my opinion.
Stephen.
Well, just one quick comment on that. You know, this gentleman was talking about maybe trying to start a new business. And, of course, that's really the power of the American economy is the entrepreneurial spirit of Americans. And one of the things that I find wrong with the economy is not that consumers aren't spending, as Robert Reich is talking about. It's that people who want to start new businesses are starved for capital. You just can't get the money today to start these new businesses.
No, I agree. I completely agree with that. There's a long-term matter. We have greater and greater concentration of corporate wealth as well. When the antitrust division of the Justice Department under the Bush administration throws up its hands and says, okay, Microsoft, you can go ahead and do what you want to do, that means that Microsoft can use its political power and its market power to make it harder for small businesses to get into that technology market.
But Robert, who helps Rick? Is there a department of the government that provides some startup capital, or does he have to wait around for venture capitalists to get behind?
Well, right now, venture capital is where the action is if the economy got better, Dick. Right now, at this moment, there's almost no venture capital. Nobody wants to invest anything anywhere because they're worried that the economy is not going to get better. When the economy does start turning around, again, we have to draw the distinction in this conversation between short-term business cycle trough and the long-term structure of the economy. When the economy gets better, there will be more capital around, but can we as a nation do a better job of providing micro-lending and small business capital? Absolutely. Democrat or Republican, that ought to be a high priority for the administration.
Rick, are you still there? Nope, Rick's gone.
He's busy making a business.
Let's hope so.
You know, it's interesting. I listen to the two of you, and when we do talk about the short term, there's more agreement than disagreement when we talk about tax cuts, the need for the government to start spending a bit of money. Certainly.
That's right. Steve, you and I agree on payroll tax cuts. Let's get together. We'll publish a paper about it, and people will be amazed.
If I'll go along with your payroll tax cut, if you'll go along with my capital gains cut.
Not a chance.
Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Moore, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, president of the Club for Growth to Conservative Political Action Committee. Robert Reich, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dick.
Robert's professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University. Earlier in the program, we talked with Collie Hutter, president of ClickBond Incorporated in Carson City, Nevada, and Bob Stiller, president and chief executive officer of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters in Waterbury, Vermont. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Graham Smith's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Cassettes and CDs of The Connection are available from WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced. Visit us online at www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287. This is